with whom it has close military ties through the 2010 Lancaster House treaties. But the lesson of this year must surely be that relations with France, or indeed Germany, cannot be dealt with in isolation from the wider relationship with the European Union. Downing Street has been seeking a summit between Boris Johnson and Emmanuel Macron for months, where it had hoped to build on past agreements, but has been stonewalled by the Elysee Palace, irritated by the British approach to its treaties with the European Union and its constant bad-mouthing of the project, whether over the vaccine rollout or the challenges of illegal migration. New German Chancellor Olaf Scholz attended his first EU summit just recently, but it is yet to be seen whether a date with the British Prime Minister is even in the diary. Britain might not want to be part of the European Union, but the European Union exists. Ignoring one another might be an option, but it isn't a smart one. Britain's economy heads into the new year weighed down by a decline in trade and falling business and consumer confidence. Exports were 14% below their 2018 average level in the third quarter of 2021. And there are many economists who doubt sales of UK products abroad will return to 2018 levels until 2024. Britain's car manufacturing output declined by more than a quarter in November as the combined shocks of Brexit and the after effects of the Delta variant forced factory owners, struggling with job vacancies and component shortages, to cut production. December, marred as it is by the Omicron variant, is not expected to provide a lift to an industry that exports 80% of what it makes. Samuel Toombs, chief UK economist at the consultancy Pantheon Macroeconomics, says, "Exporters have lost market share due to the woefully inadequate EU trade deal," adding, "the uncertainty over trade relationships with the European Union and other countries will continue to deter firms from making Britain their export base." On the domestic front, high street sales have failed to hit their usual Christmas peaks, and most events, indoor and outdoor, have reported declining visitors. The Bank of England, worried about the effect of inflation, became the first major central bank to raise interest rates since the pandemic started, when it increased the base rate earlier this month. While the 0.15 percentage point nudge to 0.25% is unlikely to tip any businesses or households into bankruptcy, it came at a time when official figures showed levels of corporate insolvencies already hitting pre-pandemic levels. Insolvency experts have predicted a threefold increase in bankruptcies across the United Kingdom in 2022, and probably more if interest rates rise by more than the expected 0.5 percentage points by December of next year. The Bank of England's gross domestic product growth forecast of 5% next year is beginning to look vulnerable to a downgrade, especially if the government fails to restrict the spread of the Omicron variant and consumer confidence falls further. The Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has avoided providing a further stimulus to the economy after the closure of the furlough scheme after warnings about a rise in unemployment proved unfounded, notwithstanding a £1 billion boost for the hospitality and leisure industries to support them during the crisis. However, it has become clear that high levels of inflation will be sustained well into 2022, damaging households' real disposable income and putting pressure on the Chancellor to provide more support, especially for low-income families. In April, disposable incomes will probably be hit again by a near 40% to 50% rise in Ofgem's energy price cap, which will push average inflation above 6%. At a deeper level, the Office for National Statistics, the ONS, revised data for business investment recently. It showed the money spent upgrading plant machinery and IT fell by 2.5% in the third quarter to leave private sector investment 11.7% below that seen in the fourth quarter of 2019. Taking note of the collapse in funds devoted to capital spending, the Office for Budget Responsibility, the Treasury's independent forecaster, said it could be partly laid at the door of Brexit, which had cost the UK 4% of its gross domestic product or GDP, that is around £80 billion. If any areas were to see the sunlit uplands of Brexit, the most likely were surely farming and fishing. Leave campaigners have claimed those two industries were being hamstrung by European Union rules, which government ministers could not change. Yet both have taken serious hits since last January, and there is deep anger and a sense of betrayal. Fishing is governed by international quota agreements to prevent fish stocks being destroyed by overfishing. Quotas are negotiated each December by Norway, Iceland, the Faroe Islands, Greenland, and the European Union. And in 2016, the Fisheries Minister, George Eustace, said British fishing was being harmed because the UK was denied a seat at the table. According to Jane Sandell, the chief executive of UK Fisheries, which owns Britain's largest trawler, the Kirkella, when UK officials took up the seat in December of last year, they failed. She said there was no deal with Norway. They just gave up. They decided there wasn't a deal to be done. Recently, the UK did reach a deal with Norway and the European Union. Jane Sandell said, "They've done a deal, but it's not a good deal. The Arctic cod quota is a derisory amount. We would normally have about 10,000 tonnes, but there's 500. The government said UK vessels could catch 7,000 tonnes of Arctic cod, an increase of 1,500 on last year, a statement Jane Sandell said was misleading because it was half the normal amount. She said, "We're operating at 50% of capacity next year. In the new year, we're going to have to sit down and seriously think about the way ahead. The Kirkella may be moved abroad." Not all crew are worse off, though. Those catching mackerel and other pelagic fish have seen an increase in the amount they can catch. But according to the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations, overall the fishing fleet will be £300 million worse off by 2026. According to the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations chief executive, Barry Dees, at the start of the year, many vessels had been unable to land catches in European ports due to new export rules, but those issues had been resolved. The deal signed with the European Union meant that UK fishermen could only catch 12,000 tonnes of non-quota fish in European waters, while their counterparts could take 40,000 tonnes. He said it really reflects the imbalance that was in the common fisheries policy. Farmers are less directly involved in European Union trade, but there is clear discontent about the outcome of Brexit. Farming is a significant part of the North Shropshire constituency, a Leave-dominated area that swung dramatically to the Liberal Democrats in the by-election earlier this month. The National Farmers Union said that total agri-food exports so far this year were down by 16% compared to 2019. Although the pandemic created trade problems, exports to the EU were down by 22% to £7.2 billion, but only by 2% in the rest of the world to £4 billion.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces. The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier, but the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari', says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari' noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari' announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayat, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Sari has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that.
Thank you.
In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several US and NATO officials have also noted that they're not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the US and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions, like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare, or at least posture for the preparing of, further military aid to support, either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as is usually the norm. But data about what the US troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the East, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
US President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 US troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the US another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the US and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis is anybody's guess at this point.
Hello.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
We congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the limelight.
American hypocrisy knows no limits. It not only acts as the policeman of the world, but has also appointed itself the judge of human rights. What you heard was part of an article authored by Khadija Ali, a political analyst. The article is titled, America Tortures Gitmo Inmates While Shamelessly Lectures Others About Human Rights. Stay tuned for more. American hypocrisy knows no limits. It not only acts as the policeman of the world, but has also appointed itself the judge of human rights. Its own despicable conduct at home and abroad cannot be discussed, nor that of its friends and allies, such as the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine. The U.S. has even coined fancy terms to camouflage its horrific conduct. Torture is euphemistically called enhanced interrogation technique, while kidnapping is referred to as extraordinary rendition. One would love to subject some U.S. officials to enhanced interrogation techniques and ask how they feel. These hypocritical expressions are coined in the aftermath of 9/11 and the people that were arrested accusing them of involvement in the attacks. The torture chamber at the illegally occupied Cuban island of Guantanamo Bay was opened in February 2002, where, according to Donald Rumsfeld, the people shipped there were the worst of the worst. These included boys as young as 12 and men as old as 70. Afghanistan's ambassador to Pakistan, Abdusalam Zaif, was among them. He was arrested in Islamabad, and General Musharraf's regime, in violation of all diplomatic norms, handed him to the Americans. Zaif was released from Guantanamo Bay in 2005 and went on to write a book about his experiences. At its height, there were 700 prisoners held at Gitmo. Today, there are less than 40, but lest we forget them. It is important to highlight their plight. The rest have since been released because there was absolutely no evidence of their involvement in any of the crimes of the Americans accused them of committing. Let us recall that among those incarcerated like animals in cages was Omar Khadr, barely 15, when he was brought to Gitmo in October 2002. He had multiple bullet wounds in his body after a firefight between American troops and some Taliban fighters in the village of Ayobkel.
He was accused of killing an American soldier even though forensic analysis showed he had American grenade shrapnel in his body. Omar Khadr was subjected to extreme torture, prolonged sleep deprivation, held in extremely stressful positions as well as dogs set upon him, scratching into his still fresh wounds. He was accused of being an Al-Qaeda family member since his father, Ahmad Saeed Khadr, lived in the same compound in Jalalabad where Osama bin Laden had lived. It was through the efforts of his lawyers, Dennis Edney, that he was rescued from the torture chamber in 2012. The Stephen Harper regime in Canada did everything in its power to keep him there. Khadr was forced to enter into a plea bargain to secure his release from Gitmo, even though he initially refused to do so. In return for accepting his guilt in throwing the grenade that killed Sergeant Spears, he was given a reduced sentence, of which he served 1 year in Gitmo and the rest to be served in Canada. Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainul Abidin Muhammad Hussein, was accused of being an Al-Qaeda leader. The extreme torture he was subjected to is illustrative of U.S. criminal conduct. He was captured, along with about 50 other men, in a joint operation in August 2002 by a group of FBI and CIA agents aided by Pakistani forces in Faisalabad, Pakistan. Abu Zubaydah was severely injured, shot in the thigh and stomach, and might have died, but the CIA flew in an American surgeon to patch him up. It was not a humanitarian gesture. CIA officials wanted to keep him alive to interrogate him. Even so, his captors continued to torture him by withholding pain medication. Abu Zubaydah is a Saudi citizen who in 1980s helped run the Khaldan camp, a Mujahideen training facility set up in Afghanistan with CIA help during the Soviet occupation. So the CIA knew precisely who he was, an American ally in the fight against the Soviets. Yet Rumsfeld said he was, if not the number two, very close to the number two person in Al-Qaeda. The CIA informed Assistant Attorney General J. Bybee that he served as Osama bin Laden's senior lieutenant. In that capacity, he has managed a network of training camps. He also acted as an Al-Qaeda coordinator of external contacts and foreign communications, the agency alleged. George W. Bush, a complete dunce, used his case to justify the CIA's enhanced interrogation program, claiming that he had run a terrorist camp in Afghanistan where some of the 9/11 hijackers trained and that he helped smuggle Al-Qaeda leaders out of Afghanistan so that they would not be captured by U.S. military forces. But as Rebecca Gordon reveals in her brilliant piece in Counterpunch, none of it was true. American officials lied through their teeth to justify their crimes against Abu Zubaydah and many other innocent people. The CIA hired two contractors, the psychologists Bruce Jessen and James Mitchell, to work on Abu Zubaydah. Their mission was to induce what they called learned helplessness, meant to reduce a suspect's resistance to interrogation. They charged $81 million for their services to test their theories about using torture to extract information. Using a plan drawn up by Jessen and Mitchell, Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times in the course of a single month. What is waterboarding? It included strapping a victim to a wooden board, placing cloth over his entire face, and gradually pouring water through the cloth until he began to chalk. At one point during this endless cycle of torture, the Senate committee reported that Abu Zubaydah became completely unresponsive, with bubbles rising through his open, full mouth. Each of those 83 uses of what was called
the watering cycle consisted of four steps. Number one, demands for information interspersed with the application of the water just short of blocking his airway. Number two, escalation of the amount of water applied until it blocked his airway and he started to have involuntary spasms. Number three, raising the waterboard to clear subject's airway. And number four, lowering of the waterboard and return to demands for information. Throughout, the CIA videotaped Abu Zubaydah's torture, but destroyed the tapes in 2005 when the news of their existence leaked and the embarrassment and possible future culpability of the agency seemed increasingly to be at stake. CIA Director Michael Hayden would later assure CNN that the tapes had been destroyed only because they no longer had intelligence value and they posed a security risk, whose security one wonders. In addition to waterboarding, the Senate Torture Report indicates that Abu Zubaydah endured excruciating stress positions which caused terrible pain without leaving a mark, sleep deprivation for up to 180 hours, which generally induces hallucinations or psychosis, unrelenting exposure to loud noises, another psychosis inducer, walling, the agency's term for repeatedly slamming the shoulder blades into a flexible false wall. Though Abu Zubaydah told the International Committee of the Red Cross that when this was first done to him, he was slammed directly against a hard concrete wall. And confinement for hours in a box so cramped that he could not stand up inside it. All of these methods of torture had been given explicit approval in a memo written to the CIA's head lawyer, John Rizzo, by Jay Bybee, who was then serving in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. In that memo, Bybee approved the use of 10 different techniques on Abu Zubaydah. Make no mistake, American officials are war criminals and torturers. The U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Torture report on December 2014 confirmed this in writing.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. Well, today life in the Western civilization is based on greed and avarice. Today, the basis of all Western values is money. Science is at the service of killing people. Science and technology are at the service of killing people. Sometimes, one uses money to produce such and such a vaccine and medicine to save a number of people. And sometimes, one uses it to build weapons of mass destruction and chemical and atomic weapons, which kill a hundredfold amount of people. This has already happened, and it continues to happen in the world. I can equally mention the plunder of weak countries, extreme moral decadence and chaos, homosexuality, and the like that one is ashamed even mentioning them. Today, a strange sexual chaos exists in the world. These are things that existed in those days and in the present time. However, in those days, such things were limited in scope, but today they are very large in scope and are done in a systematic way. For many of these forms of corruption and vices, fake rationalizations have been fabricated.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They have fabricated an intellectual basis and source of support for it, and they present it to humanity. So this modern ignorance is there in the world today. Therefore, if someone refers to today's Western civilization as modern ignorance, as some people have already done, they are right, because it is the same ignorance, but it is showing itself in a modern and modernized way. So what should we do? We should review the lessons of Ba'tha. We should treat today's ignorance in the same way the Holy Prophet ﷺ treated those days' ignorance. This is our responsibility. We should primarily strengthen faith, an important duty for us and for all those who love humanity throughout the world, is to strengthen religious faith and to develop pious and resistant groups all over the globe. People who are religiously motivated, who have faith, who are resistant and who work hard. These groups should be expanded.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewer systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated raw sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Raw sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their pumping wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe with full meaning. Shortage of water, and at the same time we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Amid the ongoing fuel crisis in Yemen, the Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to shed further light on the catastrophic consequences of Saudi Arabia's illegal seizure of Yemen's oil ships.
The intensification of the siege and the attempt to harm the public service sectors, especially the health sector, which needs electricity permanently, will cause more civilians, including women and children, to be killed. We believe that the United Nations is seeking to prolong the war to benefit from the donor countries' funds, and also because it grants fuel ships transit permits and then provides political cover-up for the piracy acts carried out by the Saudi-led coalition.
Ministry of Human Rights says the fuel crisis has impacted all aspects of life in the war-torn country, including healthcare services, transportation, and public services.
We held this press conference in the presence of many service sector officials to send a message to the world that those who pay lip service to human rights are themselves besieging the Yemeni people. The humanitarian situation today continues to deteriorate, and the Saudi blockade has affected all aspects of life, including the health sector, transportation, and public services. The international community must take serious steps to end the Saudi war in Yemen as they seek to end the Russian-Ukrainian conflict.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the blockade it has imposed on Yemen and has prevented the entry of fuel ships to Hodeidah port despite obtaining UN permits. This has led Yemen to the worst fuel crisis since the beginning of the war on March 2015.
People here say the Yemeni army's recent retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia's vital facilities are a normal reaction to Riyadh's illegal measures against Yemen's fuel imports. They believe that the Yemeni army will eventually break the Saudi siege, as Riyadh only understands the language of force. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Since late last week, France has seen nationwide anti-government protests almost every day. March 17th's protests were over better pay and working conditions. March 19th saw the yellow vests and protests against state-sponsored Islamophobia and racism. While March 21st saw the record price of gasoline cause taxi drivers, truckers, fishermen, and others to protest nationwide. President Emmanuel Macron has joined the European Union's unprecedented sanction drive against top energy supplier Russia for its military operation in Ukraine, regardless of the economic costs on the average French household. The price of petrol has crossed the psychological barrier of 2 euros per liter, creating inflation in goods across the board. Those on low and fixed incomes are now being told to make sacrifices by politicians who may be living far more comfortable lifestyles.
Moi, je pense qu'ils souffrent vraiment.
I think that people are really suffering. Unfortunately, this doesn't mean much to our leaders. There are elderly people who live off canned sardines, if not canned cat food. French politics is 30 years behind where it should be. And if it doesn't change, there might be a civil war here.
Adding to the hardships being asked of the average French voter, Macron recently announced that if re-elected, he will raise the retirement age to 65. That has caused the left-wing candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to jump in the first-round polls to third place, but he still trails the far-right's Marine Le Pen by several points.
They aren't even talking about inflation in the election campaign. For everyone in France, it's big news, but not to our candidates. Everyone who isn't rich is wondering if the energy price increases are ever going to stop, while the poor wonder if they are ever going to be targeted by government aid.
While inflation has soared, it's not like this is a new problem for the average French person. Despite long-time official claims of low inflation, reduced purchasing power has been the number one issue for voters in 2017 and 2012 as well. There will be at least two more days of nationwide protests this week. France's first-round presidential vote is now less than 3 weeks away. Many are saying that the final days of Macron's five-year term are ending in a typical fashion, full of anti-government protests. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
To many, poverty in England is a figment of the imagination. But with the living costs climbing up every day, just getting by is becoming more of a struggle than ever. And not just for the vulnerable.
When we go out just to do shopping for the kids, if I see like 5 years, 10 years back, £100 worth it to spend, you can buy a lot of things. But if I go today with £100 and to buy a grocery for my home or kids, I mean, I cannot even fill the basket.
Announcing a phase-out of Russian oil imports earlier this month, Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke of dark days ahead, but those days seem to be here already. Charities such as Step Change are calling on the government to increase welfare benefits and offer more help with skyrocketing energy bills. There are families who can only turn on their heating for 2 hours a day and use torches at night rather than spending on electric light. The answer from the government has left a lot to be desired. Chancellor Rishi Sunak says he cannot fully protect people from the consequences of rising prices.
There are lots of different ways he could try and play this. What he shouldn't be doing is just tinkering with, say, a little bit off the petrol or a little bit off the gas price. That won't make much difference. Focus on the weakest in society, paid for by those who are the strongest in society. Those with the broadest shoulders bear the greatest weight.
To try to curb the soaring cost of living, the Bank of England has upped interest rates, but it's a fine balance.
Landlords will soon pass on the increases. Rising interest rates affects everybody, including renters. But not everybody is affected equally, because when you're spending every last cent on housing, food and fuel, what's there to cut when the prices keep going up?
It means more people pushed into poverty. 2.5 million people in the United Kingdom used a food bank in the past year. A former prime minister has called the crisis the worst he has ever seen.
You're going to see, I'm afraid, a significant rise in the cost of living for Britons over the next 2 years. It's not just the current level of basic items, such as the cost of fuel, the general sort of power for utilities and things like that, but also the basic cost of food. Now, that's today. The bit I worry about is actually what's going to happen in 6 months, a year's time.
It's a time of ordinary people trying to deal with extraordinary price hikes, with very little in the way of respite on the horizon. Saeed Pourreza, London.
At present, the 27 nations in the European Union spend 1.5% of their economic output on weapons and troops. That is about to increase significantly because EU ministers meeting in Brussels have just adopted their strategic compass following 2 years of negotiations.
Today, the military expenditure in Europe of all member states adding up, it's about 200,000 million euros. We have to spend more.
In his press conference, Borrell highlighted that combined EU nations already spend four times more than Russia on military capabilities, but that is still not enough, he said. He insists the bloc's military plan will not